Welcome back to Occult Symbolism and Pop Culture. I'm your host, Isaac Weishaupt, and today we're starting a two-parter on the apocalypse, on the occult end times. Join me, it's a great time. We're going to look at the occult history of eschatology. I'll define that for you. Some of the key players involved. We're going to discuss Solomon, Solomon's First Temple, Hiram Abiff, occult symbolism, magic, the Goetia. We're going to deep dive into John Dee and how he made contact with angels that said, hey buddy, why don't you go ahead and end the world? And learn how he was pushing Puritan beliefs in forcing the end times and rebuilding Solomon's temple. And then we're going to wrap up part one with a little bit on the Knights Templar and some of their mystical powers. You know, they were into worshiping the Baphomet and all that stuff. And then you got to come back next week because in part two, which I've yet to complete, so this is not a comprehensive list. It might be. I don't know. I did the rough draft of it. We're going to talk Albert Pike, Freemasonry, the KKK, and we're going to take a look at this letter he allegedly wrote about three world wars. He wrote it in the 1800s. So basically he predicted the future, or it's just a conspiracy theory hoax. We're going to briefly discuss the LDS Mormons, Aleister Crowley, Charles Manson, Bill Cooper, one of my red pill daddies, theosophy. And then we're going to do a little bit deeper of a dive into QAnon, the evangelicals, Trump, traditionalism, the sound of freedom, and how all these things connect into Jerusalem and Israel as the final showdown. And then we're going to wrap up with a hearty perspective of the Orthodox Christian angle on the end times and how to behave accordingly. So a lot to get through here, folks. And, you know, obviously the inspiration for this is the conflict going on right now between Israel and Palestine. And look, I don't know. There's plenty of other truthers out there that are experts on everything, and they can tell you who to root for and who's lying. Go ahead, knock yourself out. I don't know all the ins and outs of these things. All I know is that I don't want them to do this right now. Can we not do this right now, please? It's spooky season. And I'm not trying to brace for impact right now, okay? But you can see there's a lot of occult forces at play here, pushing for different angles. And I'll let you decide what you want to decide. I don't really care. I'm anti-war, but, you know, sometimes war is needed. And I don't know. I don't know the details of the history of the Gaza Strip and Palestine and Israel. There's all kinds of videos going on and everyone's debunking everything and it's fake news media. And oh my gosh, this is quite the story when you get into these things. But you know, our angle, we talk about the occult, all right? Okay, eschatology. Let's talk about what that is. Eschatology is the concept of a final destiny of mankind, all right? It's the highest order of our place in the universe, and it's our purpose of being. It's a fancy word for the end of the world, the apocalypse. And many religions and doomsday cults have obsessed over this for, hundreds of years, right? We're going to take our own path through this topic. But eschatology is kind of what it's all about. Because when you got to understand when you're the Illuminati, and a lot of people say, well, what are the Illuminati doing? What's their goal here? Well, the Illuminati, whoever they may be, when you've stacked up enough bread and you've ridden enough jet skis and you're sitting on so much money you never have to work again, you know, I feel like most of us had the wealth that these people had, we wouldn't work anymore. You'd be like, screw it, I'm done, man. I'm living life. These people don't do that. They think there's a higher calling, and that's what makes them dangerous. That's why Bill Gates wants to tell you how to live. That's why Klaus Schwab wants to tell you how much natural gas you can use or whatever, right? And I think I got a tidbit on climate change in this somewhere. I remember. I mean, this is a lot of notes. We're going to talk about that somewhere in here too. All right. But first, let's go to where it all began. A guy named Solomon. I'm going to refer you to, well, actually I have this book handy, a book by Lon Milo Duquette, The Key to Solomon's Key. Is this the lost symbol of masonry? Pretty good book. But it tells us, because he's definitely got the occult perspective. And I'm going to give you some of the paraphrased ideas through here. So Solomon, this goes back to 9th, 10th century BC. And he points out that everything we know about Solomon comes from the Bible. Primarily the 1 Kings, 2 Chronicles, and then a variety of other religious writings from different, you know, the Jewish, Islamic, Coptic, and Ethiopian traditions. And the Bible, you know, basically tells the sort of life and times of this guy. And there are some other texts, like if you get into Kabbalah, that focus in on Solomon as a magician, which is kind of what that book is about. But the Bible says that Solomon is David's son, King David, of course, the great warrior king of Israel. And when King David died, Solomon inherited David's nation, which was the world's most powerful and wealthy nation at the time. So much so, even Egypt didn't want no beef, all right, at this point. Everyone was sucking up to Solomon. His weakness is women. He was really into the women, had hundreds of wives. But this was the environment in which Solomon decided to build the temple to the house of to house the Word of God. And what we're talking about is the Ark of the Covenant. He was going to permanently house the Ark of the Covenant inside the Holy of Holies. And King David actually tasked him to do this, because King David was storing supplies to get ready to do this. And then, I don't know, on his deathbed, he was like, hey, I need you to go ahead and do this. And the Bible said it was, I mean, tens of thousands of men, probably slaves, I'm guessing, maybe not, cutting timber in Lebanon and hewing stone in the mountains. But it took 7 years to build this massive temple, which is actually pretty impressive. And after they built it, they had a big party, you know. And when it's olden times and it's a big party, you don't want to be an animal, all right? Don't be anywhere near these people, because they ended up blood sacrificing tens of thousands of sheep and oxen in their big party. And in the temple, there were no idols allowed in the temple. Quite a concept, apparently, for that day and age. And, you know, they build a temple, everything's great. Solomon dies eventually, and after him, the kings that took over Israel were a hot mess. His son, Rehoboam, was running things, and the nation of Israel split up into Judah, which was in the south where Jerusalem and the temple were, versus proper Israel in the north. Now, Rehoboam, if you'll recall, I believe it was Westworld Season 3 was the name of the AI that was predicting the future and telling people what they could and couldn't do. It was kind of like the Minority Report deal, which I'm sure we're headed for. So Solomon dies, all these bozos take over, and they ruin everything, and the temple only lasted 33 years. Which, of course, very curious number when it comes to Freemasonry. And, okay, I got a note here. Bible scholars say it remained, oh, okay, so it basically was running for 33 years, but then it got mostly destroyed, but it remained somewhat intact for another 374 years before King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon completely destroyed it and got rid of all of it. Because apparently there's no evidence this thing exists. Like, there's no pieces of it. Like, it's just gone completely. Then after Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar, by the way, also, to bring it back to pop culture, in The Matrix, you'll notice one of the ships is named the Nebuchadnezzar. And after Nebuchadnezzar died, descendants of the Hebrews were finally allowed to return to rebuild the temple because there was a Persian king named Cyrus the Great who was very lenient. It was like, hey, let those Jews back on that land. They can rebuild their temple. It's fine. So the second temple, also known as Herod's temple, was built, I believe this is about 500 years later, in the 5th century BC. This thing lasted a whole lot longer, lasted till 70 CE, when, you know, so what is that, like about 570 years? But then Rome took it down during a siege of Jerusalem. And this was the temple, the Herod's temple was actually the temple that Christ went to and warned the Jews they were going the wrong way and was flipping over the money-changing tables and all that stuff. Now, let's talk about the temple location. It's called the Temple Mount. And the Temple Mount is very important in the history of religions, the Abrahamic religions, I should say, because because this is allegedly where Abraham was going to sacrifice his son Isaac to God, and it's also the location where Jacob had his dream that he saw the ladder to heaven, the stairway to heaven. And that ladder iconography is seen in Freemasonry. Or it's proof of aliens if you're into Eric Von Daniken and the ancient alien theory. And it's alleged that an angel visited King David, you know, way back when, and told him that this was the place where he was going to build this first temple. It's on Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. Anyway, it's the most revered holy site on earth by the Abrahamic religions, by Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, because they all have roots there. So currently, the Muslims have the Dome of the Rock at the location where the original Solomon's Temple was, which has the foundation stone on its floor, and the foundation stone is where the Jews believe that this was where the creation of the world began. You should look up pictures of it. It's pretty interesting. And then below the foundation stone, there's a cavern. It's called the Well of Souls, and this is a little cave where it was believed that the original Holy of Holies was contained, with that held the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the master builder of the temple, the architect, was Hiram Abiff. And this is where the Freemasons get their origin story from. Now, is it true or not? We don't know. Doesn't really matter, because there's allegory involved, even if it's not true. Because Hiram Abiff was allegedly killed inside the temple by 3 hoodlums for not revealing his secrets of the master mason. And if you fast forward about 2,000 years, Joseph Smith, who was, you know, ran from town to town trying to kickstart Mormonism, he was killed. He was in prison for whatever in, I think, Illinois, in Nauvoo. I could be wrong. And there was a riot because everyone hated this guy. It was a riot to kill the dude. So they drug this dude out of the jail, the town, and he allegedly was killed using the Freemasonic grand hailing sign of distress and talking about how he was the widow's son, a term used to refer to Hiram Abiff. Now, it could be that he was using Freemasonic secrety terms to see if there was another Freemason out there, a wandering brother that could help him out, and apparently there wasn't. But Hiram Abiff's story is an allegory, which is all of Freemasonry, which means there's an exoteric lesson. That's the lesson for the normies to understand. And then there's the esoteric message, which is only for the initiates to fully understand. And the exoteric lesson of Hiram Abiff is about integrity and keeping your word, keeping your mouth shut, the vow of silence, if you will. And Albert Mackey said there was over 17 actual lessons, and some of these are esoteric, I argue that maybe they're all exoteric because I'm reading them on the VirginiaRoyalArch.org website. Yeah. So I don't know. But it includes such things as the Legend of Osiris, which, as we know, is the death and resurrection stuff, which is also, we did a show in 2020 about American occultism and QAnon and how they do a ritual inside the House of the Temple in Washington, D.C. for every new president to infuse the spirit of Osiris. Wild stuff. But anyway, then there's like ceremony of initiation and the persecution of the Templars, to name a few of these possibly esoteric lessons to be had. Now, when you look at the occult symbolism of the temple, on the front porch, before you could even walk in, there were two large pillars, and we talk about this all the time. These were referred to as Boaz and Jachin. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Jachin. They were depicted typically as one being white and one being black, which gives us the opposing polarity concept, which you see on the floor of Freemason temples, which allegedly inside Solomon's temple also had this tessellating pattern of black and white, just like you see on the chessboard. And you can see these in The Holy Mountain, that occult movie by Hodorowski. But they apparently in real life were bronze or brass. And another example of how they show up in the occult is when you compare it to the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. And the Kabbalistic Tree of Life has three vertical pillars, if you look at it. The two outer pillars, the twin pillars, if you will, are severity and mercy. Whereas the middle pillar, which I've heard to refer to as the pillar of consciousness, represents harmony. And the significance is that the Boaz and Jachin represents the entrance to the sacred, mysterious place. It's a gateway. Much like the, you know, eight wonders of the world, you had the pillars of Hercules at the Rock of Gibraltar, and that was supposedly the gateway to the New World. And of course, we've heard this being discussed with 9/11, right? We did several shows on 9/11. I think it was last year or the year before. And the twin pillars, of course, represented the Boaz and Jachin, the entrance to the mystical realm. So when they were torn down with a vertical being put up in the center, that was like raising the pillar of consciousness, taking down the other twin pillars of Kabbalistic Tree of Life and making the pillar of consciousness. Now, if you've been watching the news, you'll know there was a guy who jumped into the memorial where the cavities of the two twin towers were. So this dude jumped like 30 feet into this thing. And someone named Dumbcube sent me an email, and rightfully so, pointed out that on the New York Post, the article about this was written by Larry Salona. This is the guy who broke the Epstein case, the Ghislaine case, and is featured in Eyes Wide Shut, if you've heard all my Eyes Wide Shut analysis. But yeah, this dude just jumped down in there to take a look at what was in that center cavity. I wonder what he saw. I don't know. You also see the Boaz and Jachin pillars in Freemason iconography all the time, right next to the ladders. You'll see it on the High Priestess tarot card. It's all over the place. It just means you're entering a different realm. It's kind of like preparation for the ritual. Now, there's a lot of talk about the Ring of Solomon, and many people think that it's a ring that one wears on their finger, but that's not necessarily true. Lon Milo Duquette goes into detail about the Ring of Solomon. It's more of a circular seal. It's kind of what it is. And because Solomon used magical spells to have 72 demonic spirits build the temple for him. That's the story. And after he was done with the demonic spirits, I mean, I did say it took 7 years. That was not that long. But then he used this, what they call the vessel of brass, to contain the evil spirits, and then he sealed it shut with the Solomon sigil, the Ring of Solomon. And supposedly it's at the bottom of the ocean, so if they ever dig that up, bad news bears. Also, I must say that if you're into Twin Peaks, which I know you are by now, there is an illustration in here, in this book, by Lon Milo Duquette, of the brass vessel. And I'll be damned, it's called the Vessel of Brass. If you're watching the video version of this, if you're on the tier 2, I'll try to zoom in on it. You can see the Vessel of Brass, and it looks very similar to, I think it's in Fire Walk With Me, I could be wrong, where the man from another place, it's in the Red Room, and that's where the ring, the Black Lodge ring, the Jade Ring, is sitting on top of it. Makes sense. Now, the Ring of Solomon is also described as a hexagram. Like a 6.8, like the Star of David, right? And this ring gave Solomon the power to speak to animals, demons. And also, I should add a caveat. Sometimes the seal of Solomon, the Ring of Solomon, is shown as a pentagram, which is the star. Because this goes back to Pythagoras. It's basically a reference to magic. But Israel opted for the hexagram on the flag. And it is, in fact, if you go to the Wikipedia, you'll see the flag. It is, in fact, based upon the magical seal of Solomon. That's what it's for. That's what the Star of David is. And it's believed that the archangel Michael gave Solomon this magical ring directly from God. That's why it was so powerful. There's also a thing called the Lesser Key of Solomon, and this is a spell book, a grimoire, if you will, hundreds of years after Solomon's life. That's what they call it. They call it the Lesser Key of Solomon. It's a spell book, and it pertains mostly to Goetia, which is low magic, as opposed to high magic, which is Theurgia. The low magic or Goetia is more practical magic, right? Because high magic is ceremonial magic. You already know that. We already talked about this. But low magic or Goetia, it's kind of frowned upon. It's like, I don't know, like white trashy, I guess. But the point is, you could use these Lesser Key of Solomon, the Goetia, to try to do what Solomon was doing with his ring. That's control demonic spirits. And those 72 demons that Solomon controlled, you can see their sigils for each one of them. And in the Lesser Key of Solomon. And these demon sigils, they show up in pop culture. A Hereditary, probably the scariest film of all time. And our beloved Twin Peaks. And you might not be there yet. I think it's in season 2. So if you're on the fence about continuing that Twin Peaks journey, you gotta hold out. He didn't flood you with all the occult messaging at the beginning. It kind of gets, you gotta want it. It's paced out there. So you've got Solomon's Temple, then you've got Herod's Temple, and now the fantasies of the end times, which includes the concept of building a third temple. And the idea is that they need to rebuild the temple on the Temple Mount, which is where the Dome of the Rock is right now. And the Jews believe that, and Christians believe that, in the final age, when they build this temple for the third time, we'll have universal peace. And some of the Christians believe that the temple will be built in order to trigger the return of Christ. And some of these folks, like the Mormons, think that when the Jews build this third temple, Jesus is coming back. And I shouldn't pick on the Mormons. I think the evangelicals believe this too. So when Christ comes back, the Jews will finally see the error in their ways, and they will acknowledge Christ as the Messiah. because that's all part of the end times. They need the Jews to convert to Christianity. And the Mormons think that Jesus is going to take thrones in two of their temples to control the world from. Well, and one of which is in Independence, Missouri. Seems odd. Seems odd. Christ would stay there. I mean, I would myself choose Maui or Malibu or, I don't know, something like with nice weather. Seems odd. But all to be fair, all of it seems pretty odd, okay? That's my beef with religion. Like, people who get so cemented in their opinion, I'm like, bro, they all sound a little crazy, honestly. And look, I'm still a Christian warrior. I'm very Orthodox. You're going to find out by the end of episode two, part two. I'm going to tell you the Orthodox perspective. But, like, let's all be a little bit lenient with one another and our beliefs. All right? That's what they need to be doing in the Middle East. But it's this rigorous, like, no, this is the truth, and you are definitely wrong. Like, I don't know. It all sounds a little nutty. So John Dee, let's talk about this guy. We've referenced him many times on this show. I wanted to do a deep dive into him. It'd be a massive deep dive. I don't know. I don't know how I'm going to do this. I'm going to refer you to a book I have called The Occult Encyclopedia. I'm going to paraphrase you some notes from it. Towards his later years, we're in the 1580s, he was really into scriptural prophecy. And he and Edward Kelly were scrying angelic revelation. And he thought November 1583 was going to be the precise time the world would end. Of course he's wrong. Like all these people are wrong. Everyone predicts the end times. Everyone knows exactly when it's going to happen. They're always wrong. But they thought that this guy, Albrecht Lasky, was going to be the last world emperor. And when he was going around telling everyone this stuff, and when it didn't happen, he was like, eh, I'm going to go back to alchemy. I'm going to figure out the Philosopher's Stone instead. And there's another book. Jason Liu wrote the most comprehensive book you could imagine on John Dee, called John Dee and the Empire of Angels. Shout out to Jordan, who runs Wind and Sea Coffee. I'm always plugging Wind and Sea Coffee. It's not a sponsor. It's not an ad. I just love it, and I think Jordan's a great guy. I consider him a friend. He sent me John Dee and the Empire of Angels, and it's an amazing book. And I'm probably two-thirds through it, and Jordan, you should see it. I've got notes and all the damn margins. That's why it's like overwhelming. I'm like, bro, I can't do a show on John Dee. This is like 20 shows because it's a massive... dense book. It's actually, I mean, I don't know how Jason Liu wrote this thing, man. It's impressive. But if you want to know all about John Dee, that's probably the book you should start with. I'm going to read you from it, though. If Hermetic magic was concerned with repairing the fallen nature of the individual alchemist, its ultimate goal, at least as expressed by Dee, hang on, I got to switch pages here. It's okay, hang on. Let's see here. Blah, 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 blah. At least expressed by Dee, was the repair of the fallen nature of the entire world by catalyzing the second coming of Christ. For Dee and many to follow him, it was thought necessary to help this to occur through enlightened human activity, the great work. Indeed, the second half of Dee's life was consumed by following the dictates of impatient angels, intent on using human agents to advance history toward the apocalypse. So it's the idea that man is corrupted, and thus so is the world. And these angels were like, hey, you know what you should do, John Dee? You should end the world. You should bring about the second coming of Christ. And the fault in this logic, the insanity of this, and I will condemn the evangelicals for wanting this too. I don't know where they got lost, but God's going to come back when he is good and ready. It has nothing to do with the humans. You're not going to tell God when to come back. Are you kidding me? I don't think they look at it that way. That's how I look at it. they look at it as, no, God's talking to me. These angels are talking to me, and they want us to do this to trigger it. And it's just the faulty logic of man's ego. But apparently, you could read from that every time the Freemasons talk about the great work, in my previous studies, I thought that the great work was meaning the man becoming God. From this, you could maybe think the great work is about ending the world, which is also pretty powerful. And apparently that's what the angels were telling John Dee, like, hey, bro, you should just end this thing. And then they talk about the book of Revelation being written by a Jewish prophet named John of Patmos after the death of Christ. And it's referring to the destruction of the Herod's temple by Rome, which, you know, happened in 70 AD. During the reign of Nero. And that Revelation is written from the perspective of the Jews who had accepted Christ as the Messiah, which I thought was another name for Gentiles. I don't know. And this was not referring to the same, like St. Paul's converts to Christianity. It's like two different groups of people. But anyways, the book of Revelation was a prophecy of a battle between the Jewish followers of Christ against evil, which was Rome, and Paul's converts to Christianity, which were frowned upon because they weren't Jewish people. They were pagans. Okay? So it's like you got former Jews that turned into Christians, and then you got former pagans that turned into Christians, and those two were at odds, apparently. And I don't really understand what all of it means. Again, I'm not a biblical scholar, but Louv's book says that these Jewish people who believe Christ to be the Messiah were people who didn't like God's covenant being available to non-Jews, like the pagans, right? Or anyone who followed St. Paul's Christian church. And he says that the book of Revelation is a book that is actually very anti-Christian because it doesn't approve of non-Jewish Christians, you know, St. Paul's Christians. And, you know, in Orthodoxy, we do holy readings every day from Scripture, and they never do the book of Revelation, and I think maybe that's why. I don't know. I had asked a priest about that before. I said, man, we never talk about the book of Revelation. And I want to say his angle, what he told me was like, look, we don't know when the end times are happening. Man has no idea. So we don't worry about it. But I always have these questions. Like, well, then why is it in the Bible? Why don't we swap that one out for the book of Enoch or something, you know? So anyway, Dean Kelly, they get into all of this because of the So they're talking to the angels. The angels are like, hey, you should end the world. But their influence for this was around the same time there was this Puritan Protestant movement. And the Protestants and Luther would take on the idea of Rome as the Antichrist because they were, you know, against the Catholics. So they embrace this. They're like, yeah, the Catholics are part of Rome, and that's the Antichrist. We are the good force. It's that black and white idea of someone being all good or all bad. And these Puritans, they yearned for the Old Testament version of God that was down for some smiting to punish man's fallen nature. And this is where all the fire and brimstone lessons came from. It wasn't the Orthodox, it wasn't the Catholics, it was the Protestants. And these Protestants, as Puritans, wanted God to come back and smite all these sinners. They thought, let's trigger the apocalypse, Christ will come back, this will be the OT version of God, and he'll get to smiting. Bad news, all of us are sinners, so you're getting smited too, if that's... But then it's like, well, that goes against... You know, Jesus came in the flesh as God and said, hey, I'm God, and this is another sort of beef I have with Christianity. Because an Old Testament God, he was catching bodies. He was like, dude, you guys are screwing up. Boom, you're dead. And Christ came and was like, no, we should love one another. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm sacrificing myself so you don't have to do any blood sacrifices. So the Protestants, they love Old Testament, Smitey God. And the Puritans, the Protestants, they held influence for hundreds of years. And that included over John D. and Edward Kelly. They were down for this smiting too. Well, in the 1800s, there was a preacher named John Nelson Darby who, using this influence, made a rapture theology that claimed Revelation, the book of Revelation, to be a literal geopolitical event that's coming. Because this starts going into the idea of taking the Bible 100% literally, which, as I understand it, it's some literal, some allegory, poetry, you know, it's a variety of things, a variety of authors. But they're like, no, it's all literal. The earth is 2,000 years old or whatever, you know, 4,000 years old. Like, they take it very literal. But John Nelson Darby was like, no, we have this thing called the rapture, and the book of Revelation tells us all about it. It's a literal geopolitical event coming, and 144,000 Christians are going to be raptured into heaven. And the ones left behind, the losers, they're gonna have to witness this world ending confrontation. With the forces of the Antichrist, the one world government. And you can see how this goes all the way back to Luther, Dee, and Kelly, who all believe that God needs these human agents to assist and facilitate the end times, which, you know, to put it back into perspective of what's going on today, that's arguably why the U.S. is so supportive of Israel and why we're best friends. In fact, Jason Louv, and I quote, says, "It is one of the primary reasons for ongoing American support of the state of Israel." And if that's not a mind F, I don't know what is. Like, that's the reason we're over there supporting Israel, is because we want to facilitate the end of the world. It's true, though. That's the facts. They don't ever say it that way. You know, and that's what bugs me about it. It's the disingenuousness of it. Because they just say, you know, because I'm a normie, right? I'm a normie at heart. And I never really understood, because I literally don't know much about the conflict in the Middle East there. But I always kind of thought, well, Israel's the good guys, right? Just because, like, that's what, growing up in America, we think, because we're supporting them all the time. And then you find out, like, oh, we're BFFs with them because we want to facilitate the end of the world, because Protestant Christianity is sort of the dominant flavor. Okay. And that's all most of the presidents embrace that. You know, I think John F. Kennedy was the first and only Catholic president. I think all of them were some Methodist. I think George Bush was a Methodist. Crazy stuff. But anyways, this John Nelson Darby guy was the one who started this talk about a rapture and this end times thing that they want to trigger. And this is called dispensationalism. It's the idea that God needs our help to advance his kingdom on earth. Which, again, I got to point out the faulty logic in that. But, okay. And guess who else bought into Darby's dispensationalist views? The one and only Aleister Crowley. Because now we're in the 1800s, okay? And Jason Louv says that Crowley was actually raised directly in a group called John Darby's Exclusive Brethren Group in England. So he had like an extra special level of teaching. And he would go on to apply Darby's teachings about the Aeon of Horus. That's what he was talking about. Because you can see the occultists and the Protestants are both wanting this sort of apocalyptic ending. And Crowley thought, he would embrace the dark powers, the powers of the Antichrist. That's why he calls, that's why he embraced the term the Great Beast that his mother gave him. He thought he was part of the master plan for these end times. All right, let's get back to Louvre's book. Along with the rise of Jewish nationalism in the 19th century and more secular geopolitical calculations, dispensationalism is causally responsible for the British creation of a Jewish homeland in Palestine via the 1917 Balfour Declaration and America's formal recognition of the State of Israel in 1948. Remarkably, John Dee's fellow magus Isaac Newton predicted 1948 as the year of the Jews' return to Palestine. Yet this biblically literal, evangelical, or Christian Zionist theology is diametrically opposed to the original meaning of Revelation. It demands that the return of the Jews to Palestine and their subsequent conversion to Christianity is a necessary prerequisite of the Second Coming. In the one-dimensional Christian Zionist worldview, Jews are simply Christians who have yet to receive Christ. This is not far from a fringe belief. In 2006, a Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life study found that over 1 in 3 Americans believe that the State of Israel is a fulfillment of biblical prophecy of Christ's return. Christian, and this is a foot stomper here, take a listen. Christian Zionism, as exemplified by modern megachurch evangelicals like John Hagee and Greg Laurie, hinges upon the belief that evangelical Christians who support Israel will in turn receive blessings in their own lives. Drawn from Genesis 12:3, in which God tells Abraham, yada yada. So this is where the evangelicals get involved in arguably prosperity gospel. Because now, not only are we doing this great thing by ending the world so that the good Christians could be raptured into heaven, but now you're going to get some blessings. You're going to get that G-Wagon now if you can make this happen. It's insanity. I'm like, dude, why? So now we see what's going on. This is why MAGA is buddied up with some of the mega church slash evangelical movements, because they all think they're part of a higher calling. They think God needs them to facilitate the second coming. Worse yet, they think if they don't pull this off, they'll be failures in God's eyes and they will be left behind to have to watch the apocalypse battle with the Antichrist and not be in heaven with their friends. This is what Jason Louvre says. Christians go so far as to believe that failing to support Israel will mean that they will be left behind during the rapture. These premillennial ideas did not begin in the 19th century, however, just as early stirrings of Jewish Zionism can be found in the 17th century Kabbalist and self-proclaimed Jewish Messiah Sabbatai Zevi, which that name comes up all the time in the occult histories. So can stirrings of Christian Zionism be found in the Kabbalist John Dee and the prior occult tradition he exemplified. Indeed, the conversion of the Jews, as well as pagans and Muslims, to Christianity as a pre-apocalyptic necessity was central to the plans of Dee's angels. More overt calls for Christian Zionism can be found in the decades following Dee's death, notably in the literal, premillennial, and Kabbalah-influenced tract The World's Great Restoration in 1681, which argued that the Jews would return to Palestine in the later half of the 17th century prior to the subsequent apocalypse. I warned you, that book is dense. Such literal readings of scripture were an inevitable consequence of the printing press. To read the Word of God directly without the mediation of the church was inevitably to take it literally in many ways. So he's saying that, I guess, before the printing press, people would go to church and the priest would sort of read the Bible to them. Whereas after the printing press, everyone had a copy. And then some of these guys, like John Nelson Darby, were like, I know, let's make up a thing called the rapture. I'm reading it literally. Whereas before, the church fathers would be like, well, that part's not literal, or whatever. Protestantism itself is a phenomenon of mass printing and rising literacy rates. Yet such calls to biblical literalism and fundamentalism, let alone Zionism, were heresy during John Dee's day. Attempts by Protestant groups at Judaizing by leaning into the Old Testament and Zionist ideas were punishable by death under Elizabeth and James. James the First, sorry. One particularly zealous group of Judaizers, was the Puritans, who rejected the residual Catholicism of the Church of England and longed to live like God's original chosen people. Over 20,000 of... Oh, boy. Sorry, this is getting too... I didn't realize how clunky this was until I started reading it out loud. I mean, I basically explained all this to you, right? Louvre goes... Okay, yeah, here we go. Back to my notes. Louvre goes on to discuss how the Christian Zionists were kind of okay with the Holocaust, too. They saw it as part of this larger plan to get Jews to convert to Christianity and get them back to Palestine. Because, again, they got to set up this third temple. It's like a two-step plan. They need to rebuild the third temple, and the Jews need to convert to Christianity, and bam, here comes Christ. That's what they believe. So imagine their excitement when in 1948, Israel became an actual state, right? That was kind of flaming the fans of their fantasy of the Jews rebuilding the Third Temple and converting. So you can see why a lot of people embrace that concept that Israel should own that land because of all these things. Then it goes on, America would have its own culture wars and the eroding of the dominance of Christianity because of the 1960s and the liberalization of America. And in the 70s, a book written by Hal Lindsey called The Late Great Planet Earth was released. It became a bestseller. It was an apocalyptic literature that said the Antichrist would rise through communist subversion. Then Ronald Reagan read it, and he said that he started buying into that idea of communism being the trigger for the Antichrist, and said that the book of Ezekiel had a prophecy of Russia being destroyed by nukes. Ronald Reagan told a state senator, everything is in place for the Battle of Armageddon and the Second Coming of Christ. And Jason Louvre makes the point that the nukes America would be, you know, in the Cold War with Russia in the 80s, were actually made with technology by John Parsons, the Antichrist himself and follower of Aleister Crowley. Oh, we're almost done, folks. Hang in there. So Bush Sr. and Jr., they were both into this, and I think they were Methodists. Bush Jr. tried to get support of, when he invaded Iraq, tried to get the support of the French. Remember the Coalition of the Willing. And he told the French he saw Gog and Magog at work in Middle East, which is coded language for, hey, we got to trigger the end times, apparently. And Louvre says that Mike Pence was the most extreme Christian Zionist to occupy the White House in American history. I didn't know that. And that Trump embodied the same desires, which was to obliterate any enemy of Christ or obliterate any satanic influence or any communist subversion like Ronnie Reagan was worried about. Which is confusing, right? Because it's like, on the one hand, if you need these things to facilitate the end times, then why, and that's what you want, then why are you trying to stop any of this? You know? That's what I don't understand. But the conflict for Israel is that they like the American support. You know, we send them weapon systems and money to try to, you know, protect themselves. But they also know that most of it actually comes from Christian Zionists, which is actually an anti-Semitic belief system. Meaning, we only support them because we need them as a tool for the end times. Like, we were a little bit okay with the Holocaust, right? That's why all those corporations were funding the Nazis at the beginning of it. Because we need them to denounce their Jewish beliefs at some point in this system, okay? at some point they got to get with the program and convert to Christianity. That's the idea. So you can see how they're like, well, we'll take all this money, thank you, but you're kind of, you know, like if I was Jewish, I'd be like, bro, keep your money, dude. I'm going to believe what I want to believe. We'll sit here and it's like people are drooling over this, like watching. I'm like, yeah, I can't wait. It's so creepy. So to sum up John Dee, let's move on from John Dee. John Dee and the Puritans and the Protestants, they have an interest in all of these nightmarish visions becoming reality because they think it's part of God's plan and they'll be rewarded handsomely, either through the rapture up into heaven, which is a false doctrine, by the way, according to the Orthodox Church, or blessings on earth, prosperity gospel nonsense, because they think that it's part of God's plan to create the new Jerusalem and the final restoration of the fallen world. And one of the angels who talked to John Dee warned of what these future end times were going to look like. Pregnant women giving birth to monsters, kings of the earth destroyed, the vain would drink the blood of their neighbors and children, which is kind of like a adrenochrome reference, I think. You know, virgins would despise their virginity and become concubines for Satan, and the world's books would become corrupt and a firebrand to the conscious. So you can see how a lot of people believe that that's what's going on. Because there's a lot of people banning books and libraries and stuff now. And, you know, and the virginity is despising virginity. I mean, I don't know. Like, I mean, sex sells itself, right? But, you know, hoes gonna hoe, right? And look, men can be hoes too. And I'm certainly not above it, right? We're all guilty of the sins of the flesh. I just find it hard to believe that it's worse now than it was in the past or whatever, right? Okay, moving on. Last topic, and then we're done with part one. And I'm exhausted. The Knights Templars. Now, the reason we're talking about the Knights Templars is because their original name is actually the Order of Solomon's Temple. The full name is the Poor Fellow Soldiers of Christ and of the Temple of Solomon. Because they were founded in 1119, and their headquarters was at the Temple Mount above what was believed to be the ruins of Solomon's first temple. And the irony is that I'm recording this on Friday, October 13th, Friday the 13th, because that was the date popularized by the Knights Templar, referring to October 13th, 1307, when King Philip ordered the Grand Master Jacques de Molay and the Knights Templars to be arrested for heresy. It was, because the church was trying to destroy these esoteric threats of the Templars. Now, a few of these knights escaped and hid out and allegedly spread under different names to different secret societies. But these guys were accused of worshiping the Baphomet, which could have been the goat of Mendes. It could have been the head of St. John the Baptist, which allegedly they found under the Temple Mount. They were accused of spitting on the cross, performing homosexual rituals. But then the defenders say, well, the knights that confessed to these things were tortured, which torture is not a good method to get a confession, apparently. So did they truly do these things they were accused of? The Book of Jeremiah and some of the Dead Sea Scrolls used a cipher that swaps the letters in a word, and when you apply the cipher to Baphomet, you get wisdom. And this idea is what ties people into thinking that the Knights Templar were pushing a Gnostic, you know, Cathar sort of vibe. Because it's about the Sophia, the wisdom. And like I said, they were torturing. This is during the Inquisition. And which, by the way, you go into an altered state. That's why people, I think, get into that with like S&M stuff. Anyways, the Grand Master Jacques de Molay was eventually burned at the stake for his beliefs because he would not recant or confess or whatever. And Jacques de Molay went down in history as someone to look up to, apparently. Walt Disney would become a member of the Order of de Molay, which is for the kids. It's like a kid's version of Freemasonry or something. And to be fair, Bill Cooper also was a member of the Order of Dame Malay when he was a child. He said he was intrigued by the ritual of it all, but left the group when his family moved, and he was always suspicious that his membership in the Order of Dame Malay was what opened the doors for him to work in naval intelligence and to see that USO that he saw. Crazy stuff. We'll talk about Bill Cooper in part two just a little bit more. Now, what's interesting is that November 22nd was also the second order to arrest the Templars. It was like the Friday the 13th Electric Boogaloo 2, right? But 11/22 is curious because that's the date of the JFK assassination, which, go back to our story of Hiram Abiff having three hoodlums, you know, kill him. Well, there were supposedly three tramps, three homeless guys that were originally investigated into the death of JFK. So some people say, like James Shelby Downard, that was all occult symbolism ritual is what that was. So while the Templars were at the Temple Mount, officially what they were doing was assisting Christians making passage into the Holy Land during the Holy Crusades. But allegedly, what they were really doing was performing rituals and looking for artifacts. And they found them. They supposedly found the Holy Grail, the Turin Shroud, the head of St. John the Baptist, which ties into the Baphomet conspiracies. And this is supposedly how they amassed an entire fortune. And there's a whole lot more we can go into with that. In fact, I'm going to put a link in the show notes. I did a full show on the Knights Templar and Friday the 13th. When did I do this here? Let me check my own link out. I think it was in 21. Either way, I'm going to put a link in the show notes. Hang on, folks. I'm almost done. Just hang in there. You can wait a second. May 16th, 2022. I released that. So you can go check that out. And while you're there, sign up for my free email news list. You're going to get a copy of my first book for free. Wow. What a guy. So, I did a whole show, Friday the 13th, Knights Templar History and Symbolism, Baphomet, Double Cross, and more. So that was a really good one. But stay subscribed to the show because on part two next week, we're going to wrap up this apocalypse discussion. We're going to talk about Albert Pike, Freemasonry, the KKK, his supposed letter predicting three world wars. In the 1800s, he wrote it. Oh, no. But we're going to debunk it. Plot spoiler. Then we're going to briefly discuss beliefs held by the LDS Mormons, Charles Manson, Crowley, Bill Cooper, and Theosophy, which, of course, leads into Twin Peaks talk, if you want to go that route. The Maitreya, maybe. And then we're going to deep dive into how these things connect with QAnon, the evangelicals, Trump, traditionalism, the Sound of Freedom, and how this connects into the final showdown in Jerusalem and how they all want it. And then I'm going to give you the Orthodox perspective. And then you're going to go about your merry way. And it's going to be a great day for you. So, check that all out. Till next time. Oh, you know what? I need to tell you about the sponsor. I got a sponsor, HelloFresh. If you're on the supporter feed, you didn't hear the commercial, but if you go to, if you want to support the show and you get great, you get some meals, right? I started doing this a few months ago and I love it. I do a couple a week because, like, let's be honest, I'm kind of lazy and I don't like the cleanup all the time. But I do two meals a week for four people, but there's only two people living in my house, right? Me and Josie. And I'll make up a big batch of the four meals and that'll be two dinners. You know, and I'll stagger it. So it's like every other day, new meal kind of. And anyways, they're a new sponsor. So show them love to show the show love. It's at HelloFresh.com/50OSPC. You're going to get 50% off plus 15% off the next 2 months. And I think free shipping is included too. So check out HelloFresh.com/50OSPC to show our sponsor some love. All right, there you go. You know I had to take you down Grifter Alley just a little bit, just a teeny bit. Come on. All right, then if you, in the meantime, check out that Friday the 13th show I did last year. Links are in the show notes for all of this stuff. Until next time, stay woke.